Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah.
I just want more of it. Wait a minute. Hold on. More. More. Do it again.
There we go. Oh, wow. Yeah. Wow. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Hi. Welcome to the Carl Landry Record Club. We are a music appreciation podcast from the Rights to Ricky Sanchez. I am Spike, and that is Mootloo.
Hello, sir.
How are you? This is not the first new pod of 22. Well, it's not the first new pod of 2023, but it is the first pod we are recording in 2023.
Right. It's been a few weeks since our last...
Especially since our last album pod. We did the one with Jason, and then we had actually recorded our last pod before that one, so this is the first time we've done this in a while. Any New Year's resolutions for you, Mootloo?
Just to try and be more positive, you know? Mm. I know it seems kind of borderline trite, but just try to... this is going to sound cheesy, but to just try to... exist and push forward and in a sense of gratitude and infuse my mindset with more positivity, because I tend to sway towards the negative sometimes.
I feel like you are your energy is positive. You are a caring, thoughtful, all of those things. But I think people like that who end up consuming a lot of the world the way we are become internally affected more than maybe somebody who is a little more cold and less caring. Does that make sense?
That's a great way of putting it. Sometimes if you, and I appreciate that, by the way, but mm-hmm. Sometimes when you care too much or you're very sensitive, which I think a lot of artists are very sensitive.
Sure.
When there's a lot of negative toxic energy swirling around you,
mm-hmm.
You like you said, you internalize that, and it eventually it kind of wears you down, you know, and you have to find ways to sort of shift your mind away from those kind of things. And yeah, there's times where I wish I didn't. Do you ever have this thought that you wish you didn't care quite so much? Like, it's a good thing to care and be passionate about things and to place value on staying engaged, but sometimes I wish I could do a little less of that.
Yeah, I think sometimes for me it's like it's almost like the decision to when they say, what is it, like, idle hands or the devil's workshop, like there are just too many things while you're idle to occupy yourself that will fill your body and brain with negative energy. And if we didn't have those opportunities, like I make jokes about myself about, like, I obviously I do too many things and I stay too busy. And part of it is, I want to say it's a distraction, like to distract myself and keep myself like focused. But what it ends up being is that when I have free time, I end up filling that negatively. And I'm not, this isn't to say that I'm making the right decision in that, like, I could take that free time and fill it with positive things that are like less like quote unquote work or whatever. But it's so much easier to fill that time. Like the negative opportunities are so much easier than the positive opportunities are. If that makes any sense, like they're just right there. You know what I mean? Whereas the positive ones are not.
That's very well put. I can relate to that 100%. I think for me, I thrive when I'm keeping busy.
Yeah.
And being productive. And I guess you could say it's a distraction on some level, but I really think it's more just engaging with things that are constructive and productive. And that's a positive thing. You're right. The idle time, which is something that all musicians have to deal with and
sure.
all creative people have to deal with. You're a creative person, but your outlet in your day-to-day keeps you constantly engaged and constantly busy. And I think for musicians, you know, when you're not on tour, when you're not always going to be writing 24/7, you're not always going to be in the studio.
Yeah.
You can really go astray. And like you said, now there's all these things in the world that can pull you in all these directions. I think it's why, you know, I'm sober, but it's why a lot of musicians look to alcohol and drugs to
alleviate
that time, you know?
Yeah, it's so much easier. Like if I'm sitting around on a Saturday morning it's so much easier, excuse me, to jump on Twitter than it is to get my dog in the car and drive 10 minutes and go take a hike.
Right.
Which would make me infinitely happier. Infinitely happier. And that's not even that difficult to do. It's just not instant, right? And right. It doesn't provide. So anyway, well, here's to more positivity in 2023. On our podcast, we largely try to celebrate a couple of albums by taking listener suggestions and suggesting one to each other. And the goal is to sort of like dive into music and find some things that we like about music that we haven't thought about in a while, or we discovered the old fashioned way, which is telling somebody that you like it. So we do two albums every pod. One of them is suggested from you, and you can do that a number of ways. If you're listening on Spotify, if you look, and we've started to get a bunch of these suggestions. If you're listening on Spotify, if you look just under the podcast, there's a question thing where you can suggest an album. You can do it that way. You can leave it in the Apple Podcast reviews, leave us 5 stars and leave it in the review, or just go to carlandryrecordclub.com. There's a place to suggest there. So we have two albums this pod. The listener album is Songs of Our Native Daughters, which came out in 2019, featuring Amethyst Kia, Leia McCalla, Allison Russell, and Rhiannon Giddens. And that came from Nikki, who suggested it on Spotify. She says, while each of these artists could have their own dedicated pod, I would love to hear you discuss Songs of Our Native Daughters. Really enjoy the pod. I appreciate the love of music and positivity. So there you go.
That's very serendipitous. On the heels of our intro conversation.
And then my album is Weezer's Blue Album, Weezer's self-titled album, but referred to as the Blue Album because of its blue cover, which came out in 1994. So it is nearly 30 years old, which is just fucking terrifying.
It is kind of scary, like listening back to that one and being like, oh man.
30 years.
Yeah, like, really?
Yeah.
It doesn't seem like it should be that long, but
yeah,
you know.
Somebody who's 28 came out that like was born after
born
this
that
album.
Year exactly.
Yeah,
that
yeah,
record.
It's terrifying. Why don't we do the listener album for Songs of Our
Native Daughters? And who is the do we see who the listener is, like who they're
Nikki? It just says Nikki.
Nikki. Okay.
Nikki. And I see a little tiny picture of Nikki, but that's it.
Well, this was a great suggestion from Nikki because I thought this was a phenomenal album. Like you said, I'm aware of all these artists in their own right, but I think they came together on this album and created a whole greater than the sum of the parts.
So I'm not aware of any of these artists, to be quite honest with you, at least not directly. So when I saw this, there were a bunch of suggestions and some albums I had heard of, like Prince, Sign of the Times, which I'm sure we'll do as something. But I was like, for our first Spotify suggestion, I should pick something that I really didn't even know what it is at all. So this was, and everything that you're about to tell me about it will be new to me. I didn't look up anything. So, and it is a great album to talk about first.
Yeah, I was aware of a few of these artists, Rhiannon Giddens and Allison Russell, but not of Amethyst Kia and Layla McCalla. Rhiannon Giddens I know from the Carolina Chocolate Drops because I've actually seen them play and they're phenomenal.
Okay.
But I wasn't aware of this project or this record at all. So give a little backdrop on it. You mentioned the artists involved, Rhiannon Giddens on vocals, banjos. Banjo is a big part of this album.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah,
it's a musical focal point. Rhiannon Giddens on vocals, banjos, fiddle, and percussion. Amethyst Kia on vocals, 5-string banjo, and percussion. Layla McCalla on vocals, cello, tenor banjo, and guitar. And Allison Russell on vocals, 5-string banjo, clarinet, and ukulele. So these are four very talented vocalists, songwriters, / instrumentalists. And there's just such a range of performance and just incredible musicianship that you hear throughout this record. Give a little backdrop on how they came together. The group was really formed by Rhiannon Giddens, who, as I mentioned, is a member of the Grammy-winning group, the Carolina Chocolate Drops. Core focus of this project was to examine, through a historical lens, the issues of slavery, racism, and sexism, and to view it and to discuss it and explore it from the viewpoint and experiences of African-American women. Now, the name of the group was inspired by James Baldwin's Notes of a Native Son, and I just I love James Baldwin. He's one of my favorite writers. I just finished rereading Fire Next Time, I think for probably the third time, which if you haven't read that book, is just an amazing book. If you think about it, I love about James Baldwin is maybe more than any other writer, I feel like he was able to take his personal experience, very personal experiences, autobiographical experiences, and then somehow create much broader social commentaries out of that, which is a very difficult thing to do as a writer. So I love it in a sense that their band name is inspired by James Baldwin book. This is another one of his, considered one of his best works, Notes of a Native Son. Now, the idea for the project was informed by two experiences that Rhiannon Giddens had. The first was a visit she made with her 7-year-old daughter to the Smithsonian's Natural Museum of African American History and Culture in D.C. And I'll get to that once we start talking the songs, because there's one very specific thing she saw there that informed, I think, one of the songs and the core concept of the album. The second experience was a screening of Nate Parker's controversial 2016 film, The Birth of a Nation. And so she absorbed the content of these two experiences, this museum visit and watching this film, and came to the idea of this album with a concept that was sort of twofold: to take historical phrases and occurrences and to turn them into songs. And when you listen to the record, you hear that is prevalent. She also wanted to focus on the banjo and its role in 19th century black minstrel music. And you know, it's that instrument is, I'm not sure I've ever heard a record where the banjo is used as dynamically as it is here. I mean, can you recall something?
I'm not
like
a big
this
banjo guy. So I like, honestly, I just this thing of Emmett Otter's Jug Band Christmas is like from.
How much alike we are. Perhaps we're long lost brothers. We even think the same. You know, there may be others. We can always use a friend.
But no, I can't, and it's hard to not notice it as you listen through the album, honestly.
Yeah, and it was a very conscious creative decision. It was, again, the musical focal point was to focus on the banjo and its role in 19th century minstrel music. Now, once her co-producer Dirk Powell and Amethyst Kia, Layla McCalla, and Allison Russell came into the fold, in a sense, the project expanded, but maybe focused in even a bit more. The overall approach was to create a range of songs that helped document how the present-day experience of African-American women was shaped. And when you listen through this record, I think it's an album you got to go through maybe several times, because there's so much to absorb. You can focus in a bit more on what's happening musically, but then you can also kind of delve in lyrically and really focus on that.
Are they original songs? Because that was the one thing I was listening to it. I was assuming it was original songs, but then I went back through it and I was like, oh, maybe these are covers. I couldn't tell from the title of the album whether they took old songs and then redid them or so. So I wasn't aware. Are they originals?
These are mostly original songs. 11 of the 13 songs are originals. There's a Bob Marley cover, which is the song Slave Driver, and
Catch a Fire.
Song Barbados, which I'll spotlight in a second, that is taken from a poem. Well, it's twofold. The front end of that song is a poem that she saw a quote from at the Smithsonian Museum, and the back half of it is actually a poem that was written by the co-producer. And there's a kind of a thread there conceptually. So we get into it. I'll give a few album highlights, then I'm curious to kind of hear your broad and specific takes. The opening track is one of my favorites. Black
oh my
Myself.
God.
What a monster tune. Incredible
Holy
tune.
Cow. Yeah.
Talk about an opening song, you know?
Yeah, well, it was like, so you see the cover, and it's just like, it's four black women on the cover, and it's like, you know, songs of our native daughters. And then you hear it, and it like opens up with this fucking like, it sounds like a Led Zeppelin song or something. Do you know what I mean? Like, it sounds like When the Levee Breaks or something like that. Boy, it's like fucking enormous, the first song.
It pulls you in such intensity right out of the gate. And just incredibly soulful vocal performance from Amethyst Kia. She has this rich timbre and resonance in her voice that just cuts through the track. And you're right. As far as an album opener, we always talk about like the best albums have great album openers. I think this is just a phenomenal.
Oh my God. Yeah. Yeah. It was like, it woke me up, honestly. Like I was like, all right. Like I'm going to, you hear an album title, you see a cover and you sort of like have this general expectation of what it's going to be. And like from the first song, I was like, oh boy, this like I'm in for something, you know, something awesome. What an incredible opening tune. Oh my goodness.
An amazing track. If I have to think back on it, I mean, there's a lot of tunes I loved on here, but it's probably my favorite tune.
Yeah, I would agree. Yep.
It's an undeniable standout. Now, just to give a little backdrop on the inspiration for the song and the message of the song, I'm going to read a quote from Amethyst Kia. This is from an interview she did in Rewire magazine on October of 2020 about this song, Black Myself. This was an interview with James Napoli. And James Napoli asked her, he said, "How did the song Black Myself come about?" And now I'm quoting Amethyst Kia. It's a pretty long quote, but I think it really just gives great perspective on the song. She says, "There's a version of John Henry I really love by Sid Hemphill, who was a North Mississippi Hill Country musician. And in the song, he sings, 'I don't like no red black woman, black myself, black myself.' It made me think of the interracial discrimination that would happen among black people, where one of the coping mechanisms of dealing with being a second-class citizen was to find ways to either have kids that were whiter or to be lighter yourself using bleaching creams. And there were these brown societies where if your skin was darker than a paper bag, you couldn't be in. The idea was to be as light as possible, to be as European as possible, to try to be treated equally. And that was such a terrible way to have to try to cope. So the phrase, 'black myself,' kept rolling through my head. Then I sat down, and though I didn't realize it at the time, I essentially tried to pack in 400 years of history from the transatlantic slave trade to today in a 3-minute song." End quote. There's a lot to absorb there. I would actually recommend reading that whole interview if you're interested in this band and Amethyst Kia. It's a great interview that he does with her. James Napoli in the October 2020 edition of Rewire magazine interviewing Amethyst Kia. So that quote there gives a lot. It provides a lot of sort of context and background for what she's singing about. And to me, it's remarkable how much ground she covers on an issue that's as upsetting and gut-wrenching in so many ways, and that's also historically significant and complex. And she finds a way. This is the brilliance of, I don't want to call this pop songwriting, but you know, working in the pop form, that you can, when it's done well, you can take something this deep, this complex, this significant, this heartbreaking in many ways, and give it a context musically where you convey that message, and yet it's so musically compelling at the same time. Like you said, it comes in like a Zeppelin tune or something.
Yeah, like you could even not even listen to the words and feel that it is powerful.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Yes. Like there's clear like emotion and drive and all of those things to it. And even like it shows that you don't have to be fast to be have forward momentum. Like there's this sort of like ominous drive, which is why I compared it to When the Levee Breaks, like this ominous like march forward and intensity about the song without the song being fast or loud or anything like that.
Yeah, it's a powerful piece. And then once you hear this tune, you're hooked in on this record. And it goes in a lot of different directions, albeit with that core historical thread underneath it. This, another song I want to spotlight is Barbados. Now, I wouldn't even say musically it's one of my favorites, but I think it's an important song when you get the context of the record and specifically how this album was conceptualized, just to even the process of constructing the songs. Now, part of the lyric is based off a poem by William Cowper, who was a 18th century English poet. And during that, during that private tour of the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture in D.C., Rhiannon Giddens encountered a quote from that poem, from this poem by William Cowper. And just to paraphrase it, what he basically covers there, it's, you can hear it in the song, in the actual lyrics, but to basically paraphrase it, he more or less says he sees how heartless and cruel the practice of slavery is, and yet he basically admits to how he basically stays quiet about it. In his words, he says, "But I must be mum, for how could we do without sugar and rum?" And I think what was said in this poem and sort of the heartlessness, the kind of callous heartlessness of it, really struck a chord with Rhiannon Giddens, and she wanted to, in a sense, expose this thing of quiet complicity. How we can see this in many different eras. Of course, at that time, there were people who saw how truly awful and cruel and inhumane the slave trade was, and yet they stayed quiet and they normalized it. And I think that's what she wanted to speak on or represent in this song. And then you sort of hear the poem read, this poem read that she saw at the Smithsonian Museum. And then there's a long instrumental segment there. And then towards the end, there's a poem that was written by the producer, Dirk Powell. And it sort of brings that same idea into a fresh contemporary context where he basically covers this area of like talking about even our devices and how even in the making of our devices, there's a level of cruel, inhumane exploitation that comes into creating the supply chain that gives us our technology. And in some ways, we're all complicit and blinded in that. So that was a thread I took away from it. There's a lot to unpack there. But especially when you go back to that first poem that's at the front end of the song, I thought it was important to talk about this song in particular because it was one of the two key points of inspiration for Rhiannon Giddens. And again, just to kind of expose that quiet complicity of people who knew how wrong slavery was and yet just went along with it. And we can draw parallels to many different eras during different atrocities that were committed. But, you know, it speaks to a broader issue and a very specific issue at the same time. One other song I'll highlight here is I Knew I Could Fly. Another one of my favorites. It's just a beautiful tune, co-written by Layla McCalla and Allison Russell. Great harmonies on this song. It's just this very simple but moving lyrical message about the strength, courage, and conviction needed to overcome oppression and enslavement. And there's just a handful of very simple lines. A lot of them are repeated. You know, lines like, "I follow the stars, I carry my scars. I know what I hear, I won't live in fear. I sit by the stream, I'm counting my dreams, my face to the sun, my battle half won." Just a handful of lines that are repeated, and there's just a great use of economy in the lyrics, because out of those lines, you just get exactly what's being conveyed here. You get that picture of someone trying to overcome this oppression and finding the courage and the strength to do it. And I love, it's profound and it's direct and it strikes right to the heart, and all complimented with this just beautiful melody and these beautiful harmonies. So this, I thought this was just a phenomenal album. This is maybe one of the best listener picks we've had. Revelation to me. I was familiar with a few of the artists, but not of this project. There's also a documentary, which I haven't had a chance to watch yet, but I plan to, that about the making of this album. And I just love albums that serve as a platform for both historical and social commentary. I view albums like this as sort of the musicological approach to record making, or the musical historian's approach to record making. And it's very challenging to tackle these complicated subjects that when you delve into the realities of them are so heartbreaking. And these four artists just just came together and did something truly special here. And I'm curious if they'll do another project like this, but this album itself is truly a whole greater than the sum of the parts.
Yeah, I mean, and not knowing any of the history of it, musically alone, like musically alone, you can dive into this album and love every part of it. I mean, absolutely. there is so much in it. Like I mentioned the Zeppelin thing, and there's another one that has sort of like that classic rock vibe called Kwashiba, which is like brings you into that same spot. But then there's like some folksy mamas and papas vibes in there. And then like the way, honestly, even the way vocally that the thing is attacked, like I feel like there's like this powerful, it opens. I thought honestly, like one of the coolest things was the way that the album opened and the way the album closed, because the way the album opens comes with like such force with Black Myself, and then it closes with this song called You're Not Alone. Which is another big song, but I guess like brighter and like sort of like it is an interesting way to finish the album considering the way that it started. And it like it feels like there's strings in it, and even the vocal, the way that it's like attacked, for lack of a better word, vocally is so much different than the first tune was. And it takes you like you feel that they are doing something that they consider important and meaningful lyrically, but musically, the way that it sort of like goes up and down and powerful and pulls back and all of those things and is really impressive. I even think the way that it's tracked is really, really good. Like everything about the album is really cool.
Yeah, you mentioned the production and the mixing is outstanding. And yep. There's a lot of space. You hear the nuance of every vocal and every instrument. I love mixes that, you know, that provide that sort of clarity. And again, the banjo, I'm trying to think, I'm racking my brain. I've never heard the banjo used in such a broad, dynamic way as it is here. It's kind of, it is really the focal point. That was the point. That was musically, that was definitely one of the ideas or one of the core concepts that Rhiannon Giddens wanted to spotlight. And all four artists play banjo. So you have four artists who are multi-instrumentalists, great singers, all write really well. I would love to see this live. Yeah. I wonder if I imagine they've toured behind it. But again, they're all artists who are busy with other things. So I'm curious if there will be another record like this, because honestly, you could mine this same territory. You could still go even deeper into this concept that they created here. It's endless. There's so many levels to it. And so much to explore. So yeah, just really, really a great record.
Yeah, really, really cool record. I'm surprised, like I never even heard of it. I looked at it, I had never even heard of it, but it is, and it clearly, critically, that it was acclaimed and covered, but I had never heard of it. Really cool album, really great suggestion. Also makes me interested in all of the artists individually that I will, you know, that I will go back and check out, because obviously they all have a lot to add, you know?
Yeah, and I would say we played at Newport Folk Festival with Amos, and they were there. Mm. That was a while ago.
Oh, wow.
Maybe 10, 12 years ago, and Carolina Chocolate Drops, that is, with Rhiannon Giddens.
Yeah.
And that, I just remember, I'd never heard of them. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is the great thing about a festival sometimes, when you just... Whether you're there is just to watch, or if you're performing and you kind of discover artists, like you just stroll past the stage and there's something going on that just piques your interest. They were one of those bands that there's just energy around them. So yeah, she's someone, I think she's done solo work, and I don't know if the Carolina Chocolate Drops are still working together, but she's kind of a musical force to be reckoned with, and really was the mastermind behind this one. But yeah, I'm surprised I haven't heard of this record either. But you know, there's so much music out there. It's just Things get past you sometimes. You
know? There's a lot. There's certainly a lot. Well, thank you for the suggestion, Nikki. And again, if you'd like to give your suggestion for us to dive into, the more different, the better. I mean, like, pick something that you love, obviously, but do it under the Spotify, under the pod on Spotify, in the Apple Podcast reviews, or at CarlLandryRecordClub.com. All right. My album, Weezer's Blue Album from 94. Done a lot of big 90s albums, but you know, considering our age, I think it makes sense. And the 90s had a lot of great albums. And I think when you look at music now, so much of this music came from that music, that I think it is it's good to do. So Weezer's Blue Album, I remember incredibly specifically as it came out in May of 94, as I graduated high school. And it was one of the albums that bonded me to a freshman. I have not heard from this guy since freshman year, but a freshman year guy that lived on the same floor as my dorm, James Tully. Like, I remember we both liked Weezer's Blue Album and Green Day. And that was like, and immediately we were friends. And it's like, it reminds me of college so much in that I feel like I had no friends in high school who liked the same music that I did. Like, I felt like it was a small high school. It was only 100 kids. And it was a private school, and I had gotten there in eighth grade. Well, I remember this specifically. I don't know if I've ever told this story. I remember I got there in eighth grade and you had to wear a shirt and a tie or whatever. And underneath my shirt and a tie, I had a Metallica t-shirt on and some kid saw it. Michael Goody saw it and called me a Satan worshiper, and like the rest of like the week, everyone called me a Satan worshiper
for listening to Metallica.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
Well, I mean, like, you know, who knows? But it was a different time, and it was just like it reminds me of college in that one of the things about college is that there's so many people there that are your age that you find somebody, you know, like you, that you might not have found in high school. So I remember it specifically from then. It's one of the greatest debut albums of all time.
Man. I mean, when you picked this, I was like, yeah, how have we not discussed this already?
Well, it's sort of like the alternative Appetite for Destruction in some ways. It's like, I think, like, you know, when you're talking about debut albums, you have to look at that album and this album in the same sort of world. And the other thing that I think is similar to Appetite is that there are no misses on the album. And like, it is an economic album without being too short, right? Like there's no space wasted. That I think Appetite for Destruction, the Blue Album, there's nothing wasted. It just beginning to end, it is a like masterpiece. Like, you know who Weezer is. So Weezer still around, officially formed in 92 in Los Angeles when originally Rivers Cuomo moved from Connecticut to LA in 89 or 88 with his metal band, Avant Garde. And that band broke up. Now, the fact that Rivers Cuomo was like a metal guy, I think you don't initially think about when you think about the Blue Album, but when you dive into it, you can certainly hear it. Like, it's absolutely there. So that band Avant Garde breaks up, and Rivers befriends Patrick Wilson, who ends up being the drummer of the band, and Matt Sharp, who ends up playing in Weezer for the first like 5 years, plays bass and ends up being their like sort of de facto manager guy. So those guys get together with a guy named Jason Cropper, and they play in a couple of different bands before they form Weezer. And Weezer happens after Cuomo moves to Santa Monica, writes a couple of demo songs that Sharp ends up liking a lot, and that is when they form Weezer in 92. Their first gig was with an actor band that I'm sure you at least remember the existence of. And that is Keanu Reeves' Dogstar.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So they play with Dogstar, and as their
that was first, their first gig was with a
their first wow. gig as Weezer. Yes, and the way the story gets told is that like Cuomo gives Sharp a year to get a record deal, or he was going to go to Cal Berkeley to study music.
Wow, so
gives him a year.
That's a short window of time, man.
Yeah, and they make a demo called The Kitchen Tapes. It has the Sweater song on it, Undone. Know me if you want to destroy my sweater. Hold this dread as I walk away. And within 6 months, they get signed to Geffen. So, wow. Yeah. You know, and this, and what I think what is most interesting is like, you know, we've told the stories of how bands get signed, and some of them is like, you know, they build this groundswell, and Weezer didn't do that because if you think about it, in like 92, 93, Weezer's kind of music is not probably what record labels were looking for. Like that was the grunge time. It wasn't like the nerdy alt music time. It wasn't it was a different time for music. Even though we look back at it and we see Weezer as like a seminal group of the 90s, at this time, if you're thinking about how record labels particularly operate, it wasn't this sort of band that they would be looking for. So the A&R guy suggests that they have somebody produce the record instead of Rivers, and they wind up with none other than Rick Ocasek, which is a nice if you want a producer of your debut record, getting Rick Ocasek is probably not a bad thing. So Ocasek comes in, and one of the changes he makes is he has all the guitars move from the neck pickup to the bridge pickup, which is, if you're not a guitar player, like when I think of like, you know, driving rock music, it's bridge pickup, not neck pickup. That's where you get that bright, sort of like loud sound. If you think about like maybe Clapton or something, you're thinking about neck pickup when you're thinking about individual notes. But when you're thinking about like driving chords, you're thinking about the bridge pickup. And then like the whole purpose of the production of the album was for everything to be like in sync, going one direction. Like the vocals, there's a lot of gang vocals on it, and I think I read that they practiced like barbershop quartet songs to learn how to sing that way. All of the Cuomo and Sharp, I think it was Cuomo and Sharp, said that all of the guitar playing had to be all downstrokes, and everyone playing like together, playing the same thing at the same time. So the one change they make is Cropper's girlfriend gets pregnant, starts acting like erratically, and Rivers Cuomo fires him and replaces him with a guy named Brian Bell. There is a quote from Rick Ocasek. After it was completely recorded, Rivers came in and said, "I'm firing the guitar player and I'm going to do all of his guitar parts over." I said, "You can't do that." But he did in one take. So, wow. So yeah. So they record the record, and it honestly didn't take long. The first single was the Sweater song, which ended up as a huge hit video on MTV. At the time, MTV a hugely influential in what became popular. Now, they had Rick Ocasek produce the album. The person who produced the Sweater song video was Spike Jonze, who becomes, you know, ends up being one of the most famous video producers of all time. And off they went. This album has sold 15 million copies worldwide since then. Weezer has had 15 albums, has sold 35 million copies. There is, within Weezer fans, there's a debate as to whether this album or Pinkerton is better. Pinkerton is their second record. It doesn't sound the same. Like it is it's like a less tight sort of, I think the Blue Album is way better than Pinkerton. I like Pinkerton a lot, and Pinkerton has some good songs on it, but I don't think they are equal. It is an incredibly written album in like basically every sense. I said there are no misses on it. Lyrically, it is like sort of clever and honest. The songs themselves are like incredibly written pop songs. Like it has hints of so many different genres, from like metal to emo to punk to like the Beatles, you know, like all of those straight ahead, like pop rock. Just a few of my favorites, like the, we were just talking about first songs on albums. Like My Name is Jonas is just
what an opener.
Thanks for all you shown us. This is how we feel. Come sit next to me, pour yourself some tea. Just like grandma made when couldn't find sleep. Things were better.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. And, you know, I mentioned the metal influence. You can hear it on this. Like, the guitars in this album are, on this song, are so driving and so big. Like, you don't, if you listen to this song, you, I don't know that you think about what Weezer ends up being famous for, sort of like these nerdy guys and whatever, and different directions the album goes in. And by the way, this is the only song that Jason Cropper gets any writing credit on, in that he wrote the acoustic intro for this song, that little da-na-na-na-na-na-na-na. He says, I got home from work. He worked in an Italian restaurant. And I remember I was still wearing my cook's outfit. I picked up the guitar and I played the first part of what became the intro to My Name is Jonas. And Pat Wilson said, stop. Just do that. Just don't keep going to different chords. Just do those three notes, those three chords. And they kept it. That was the one thing they kept. It was one of the earliest written Weezer songs, written by Wilson and Cuomo. And it was inspired by like a car accident or something that Rivers Cuomo's brother was in. But not only does it start huge and like driving, but it ends like somehow bigger. You know, with the Rivers Cuomo repeating the same lyric over and over and over again, and the song just ending in a giant explosion before it settles down and goes away again. I love In the Garage.
I've got Ace Frehley. I've got Peter Criss waiting there for me. Yes, I do.
Which, you know, is a sort of ode to, like, you know, where you could be. You know, it talks about Dungeons and Dragons and your Kiss poster and all of those things. I think it's an amazing song with really fun lyrics. I've got an electric guitar. I play my stupid songs. I write these stupid words and I love everyone. Is a great, you know, it makes you think about being a teenager, I think. And also, by the way, the other song on the album that uses a harmonica, just like My Name is Jonas. The final single on the album was Saying Ain't So. Which is just an obvious, amazing tune. A power ballady kind of song on in some ways. It is about Rivers Cuomo seeing a beer in the fridge with his mom and his stepdad, and thinking about, like, I guess his perspective was that his stepdad's drinking, his dad's drinking had caused their divorce. Like the entire sort of like song is comes from that point. I think it is what's it called? Like, it's got like this little reggae thing the guitars do in the verses, and then this almost like epic Queen sort of thing that it does in the chorus. You know, it is a quiet, loud, quiet, which is what the '90s do so well. And then the last thing, Only in Dreams. We talked about the first album. We talked about starting and finishing like an amazing way, starting with My Name is Jonas, and then it ends with Only in Dreams, which is 8 minutes long. great hook, but sort of ends with this, like consistently builds and ends with this like several minute build up into a guitar solo and just an amazing tune. This album, beginning to end, no misses, one of the best albums of my teen years. And I think ages pretty well too.
Yeah, this is just an amazing record. You touched on My Name is Jonas. I mean, again, album opener. I think when you listen to that song, you sort of get like the core DNA of this record. You know, lyrics that are somewhat irreverent and yet incredibly heartfelt at the same time. I'm not sure how he does that, but that's a unique trait of Rimmers Cuomo's writing, is that it can be oddly detached, but somehow in the delivery of it, like the big sing-along chorus on this song, there's just so much vitality in it, and it's earnest. It's not like, it's not sort of playing too cool for the room, you know?
So, yeah, I think one of the most interesting things about him is figuring out what is earnest and what isn't. Right. I think almost like as their career has gone on, like you almost can't tell if he's doing something because he's interested in it or he's making fun of it. And that is like the older he has gotten, the more I've looked back differently upon their catalog. I think that is one thing that you could say about Pinkerton, is that it feels like, it doesn't feel like it's joking at any point. And whereas this album, you can look back on it, you can maybe wonder about it, but that is one of his skills, is being able to like walk that incredibly thin line in between those two things.
And I think that's what you touched on, something that's what makes him an incredible songwriter, is you really can't tell.
Yeah.
You know, but it feels earnest, a lot of what he says. And then you kind of can tell when it's a little bit tongue-in-cheek. I have to say, the trilogy of The World Has Turned and Left Me Here, Buddy Holly, and Undone, the Sweater Song, one of the greatest song trios of all time. I mean, well, song for song, this whole record is amazing. There's no misses on that. But that particular set of tunes, you know, I love how The World Has Turned and Left Me Here. Right in with the hook. You get the big hook right away. It just, I think you hear throughout this album on these songs and Say It Ain't So, you know, the intro song, you just hear what an incredible sense of melody he has. He's a pop songwriter of the highest level. And, you know, I didn't think about it. You said he kind of, it's an amalgam of different things that you kind of recognize. But somehow the way he synthesizes it is so distinctively
them.
It's you can't really... The way he puts it together, they put it together, there's no mistaking it. You know, another thing that he does that, and I think this pertains to The World's Turn Left Me Here, is he has the ability to write something that feels sad and introspective, and yet there's this sort of sense of melodic brightness in it.
Yeah.
That world, The World Has Turned, it should be a sad song, but it doesn't really play like a sad song. You know, again, he's always like walking multiple lines somehow.
Yep.
And that's what makes him unique. And then Buddy Holly, I think, is just one of the all-time outsider anthems, you know?
By the way, it is one of the songs I talked a lot about, like working in rock radio and getting burnt on amazing songs and then walking away from it and coming back to those songs and having like this renewed love. Buddy Holly is forever ruined by me or to me. I can't get back to how I know intellectually that it's great.
It's good, but you just heard it one too many times.
It's a skip for me. And like, it's so sad that I can't get back there, but it is just an incredible tune, an incredible video, by the way.
Absolutely. It's an iconic song and video of that era. Then the Sweater Song, which you said that was one of the tunes that was on the first demo.
Yes.
They did.
Yeah.
I'm always intrigued by songs that say something in a way that I've never heard. You know, if you want to destroy my sweater, bullets thread as I walk away. I mean, that's a visual action-based lyric, but it's so random.
Yeah.
and so memorable, and I can't compare it to any other lyric I've heard. And the fact that something like that is said in a big hit song is just is amazing to me. One of the things I like that he does on that song that I think I've heard him do, maybe not as much on this record, but maybe on other records, is he does a sort of octave vocal thing where you have his lead in his natural range, and there's kind of like a falsetto double of it, which just creates a certain sound that's really very compelling on the verses, and then amazing harmonies on that one. You know, this is just a true masterpiece. You know, it's strange because it's a record that's of that era, and yet it completely transcends that era. It's timeless. It's still putting it on now. It doesn't feel dated at all. It just, I think it could come out now and would still be a big hit. But you associate it, in your mind, you associate it with the 90s. And one other thing I'll say is the production on this
album. I was just about to say that. It's so enormous and loud. The entire thing is so bright and big, you know?
It's incredible. Sometimes I'll, just to test, like to get a gauge of what a mix really is, I like to listen in the hi-fi and the lo-fi. Like, I'll run the gamut of listening on my phone, putting it on the earbuds, but then I'll put it in this like dinky little Bluetooth speaker I have, and things actually don't really ever sound good there. Even good records don't sound good there, and I put it on that and listen to it there, and wow, even in this kind of sort of cruddy lo-fi thing that never sounds right to me, the mix is so undeniable that it just like bursts out of the speakers, and there is great clarity in the mix. You know, there's all this like heavy distortion, but it never feels brittle. And there's sort of this mix of clarity and shimmer with that heavy distortion. I never thought of them. I mean, you said the metal background. That kind of surprised me because I would never place him or them in that realm. But I guess when you think about the guitars, it makes sense. It's there.
If you go and play, it's a pretty easy song to play. It, like if you plug in a guitar into an amp and play "My Name Is Jonas," you'll feel the metal part of it. Like you just like. You hammer playing that song. Like you know what, you almost can't hit the guitar hard enough when you're doing it. And if I remember, is it in drop D? I feel like it
sounds
is.
Like it probably is.
Yeah, maybe even like it might even be lower than D. Like it might even be in C or something like that. I forget. But the it like when you play that song, you feel it. Like it's almost a different thing if you play it. Like you're like, oh, I feel what this is here, you know.
Have you ever seen them live?
Yeah. God, I'm trying to remember when. I feel like I saw them but I've only seen them in amphitheaters, like on bigger tours, which I feel like is not the right, not the right venue for them. And I wish I had seen them earlier on in their career than I ended up seeing them, you know, like I would not go see them now. I would not be interested in going seeing them now. And then I feel like I probably saw them at the wrong time in like the earlier 2000s or something like that.
And they're pretty much an arena act, I think, at this point, right?
At this point. Yeah. Well, and they're like, it's hard. They were going to do like this Broadway thing, but they decided not to do it when they released all these albums at once. They're going to do a Broadway thing and they're not doing it. But yeah, I think they're an arena act now, and they tend to tour with other big bands. So they play bigger, you know, like
Fall Out Boy,
Green Day tour. Yeah.
Which Fall Out, I get Green Day and Weezer. Fall Out Boy, I don't know how, I guess it makes sense.
Been around for 23 years, Fall Out Boy, since the early 2000s. So I think that there's a lot of people that were maybe not the early 90s part of Green Day and Weezer, but remember, like those bands were big all the way through the beginning part of the 2000s too. So I think that's where that connection. And they're all, by the way, they all have the same management. They're all managed by Crush, which is
okay.
Yeah, which is the other tie together there.
So it was kind of a myth that I remember. There was always a thing about Rivers Cuomo that he kind of was like the Bill Murray of rock music, that he didn't have a manager, or was that sort of just a myth?
I don't know how long Crush has had them. So I don't know how long, but definitely in the last few years, because that tour was COVID, like it was the beginning of COVID, and ended up getting canceled and pushed back, I think, two different years. But I don't know how long Weezer has been with Crush, but maybe that was like sort of the start of it. I don't know.
Yeah. Singular band. I can't think of. What is this era's Weezer? Like, who would you draw a parallel That's maybe a strange question, but...
Yeah. Well, you know, the band that made me think of them, that made me think of this specific album to pick, was I was talking to Andrew Perloff at work about our year-end list, and he asked me about the Beths, because the Beths were on all of our lists. And I was like, and he was like, well, what are they like? And I was like, well, they're like punk. I was like, but not like punk. I said, it comes from Weezer. Like that's where it, so that's what made me think of it. And I like, that is the, that was sort of like, the band that made me think of where it comes from. But then I also think when you think about like Fall Out Boy and things like that, as tied to emo as they are, I think they're also tied to bands like Weezer.
Well, that was going to be my next question. Are they in that? I don't think of them there. I think because I absorbed their music separately long before I had any clue what emo was.
Yeah.
And before we really got into it on the pod, but are they part of, I mean, are they considered part of that? I can see how there's an aesthetic that would make sense and appeal to that audience.
I would not call them an emo band, but again, I think it is certainly close enough to, you know, I think it is certainly, you know, a cousin of, if not a brother or a son, you know?
Yeah. And I never think of emo as being tethered to metal in any way.
It's tethered more to punk, but like when you listen to a band, we did early Fall Out Boy, right?
We did the first record, didn't we? Yeah.
There are like heavy guitar breakdowns in that. And they, even through the first two or three records, and they ended up going away from that. But remember, emo came from hardcore, which is tied to punk, but is also tied a little bit to metal too. So there are enough cousins, if you did like the entire genealogy of emo, that I think you could get back to metal somehow. It's not a direct tie, but I think there are steps you can take to get there.
Yeah, well, this record is a monster, and I hadn't listened to it in quite some time. It's one of those albums, like, you just remember, like, man, every song on here.
Yep.
Even the one you felt you have to skip because you've heard it a million times is still a monster tune.
Yeah. And it's one of those things where you remember every song. Like, there were no songs on this album that I was like, oh, I forgot that album was on. Or I forgot that song was on that album. All the songs on this album are like, oh, I remember this banger. Oh, I remember this banger. Like, song after song. By the way, an album that only had three singles, for some reason you remember, similar to Appetite for Destruction, by the way, a song that only had three singles, somehow you remember every song. More songs ended up on the radio, even though they weren't singles. So
yeah, because I'm thinking of just that trilogy of songs, Say It Ain't So, In the Garage. I mean, it feels like more than half the record is something that's been spotlighted on its own. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Great album. Great to revisit. Thank you for listening. Again, if you'd like to suggest an album, do it in the Spotify question, do it in the Apple Podcast reviews, or go to carlandryrecordclub.com and click suggest an album. We thank you for listening, and we will talk to you next time.
Stay free, my goose.